Good morning. Welcome to Radioactivity. I'm Rob Loray. Coming up today, we're going to hear a really terrific speech about the rise of fascism in Germany and what it might portend for us here in the U.S. But before we get to the speech, we're going to thank a few people who called in, and Arlene is back after the From a Woman's Point of View.
Yes, and we want to say a thank you to Nicholas Borderi for his generous pledge. He's from St. Petersburg, and he says, I greatly appreciate the perspectives you ladies bring to our community. Thank you for encouraging all of us. And then we also have a generous contribution from Rana in Tampa, and she says, thanks for everything. You cover every important issue on everything. And, you know, you're really lucky to have this public affairs station and this local station that both brings you music you wouldn't hear elsewhere, but also very important public affairs from a different perspective than you get anywhere else. So we hope you'll keep contributing to Radioactivity and Midpoint and keep your dial tuned to 88.5, 813-238-8001 and WMNF.org.
All right. Thanks, Arlene. Sean Canan is here, and we're going to try to raise a bunch of money today. We've got two more hours of public affairs, and we have to raise about $8,000 in those two more hours. So we hope that we'll do it. Thanks to Brooke Martin from Dade City, made a $100 contribution earlier, and she wants more news and not more music. All right. Well, Brooke, thank you very much. We try to keep a balance here. Sometimes we've had more public affairs than we do now, but we have this great channel, HD3, too, which is all news and talk. Well, stick around because today we're going to hear a really interesting speech about the rise of Nazism in Germany and what it means for us, what kind of lessons we could learn here in the U.S. about that. There seems to be signs of darkness all around the country, and we'll hear what a professor has to say about his scholarly study into the rise of fascism in Germany in the 1930s. But first, we got to get one line lit. We're hoping that if you're a fan of Radioactivity, which is my talk show and call-in show, that you'll make a contribution soon, like how about right now, at 813-238-8001. Always try to bring in interesting guests. A lot of the guests that I've had on Radioactivity also show up in the Alternative Radio series, and that's a series of speeches that we play every other Tuesday at 10 o'clock here on WMNF. And for a donation of $200, I'll give you five of the best, most recent speeches and interviews from alternative radio. That's for a $200 donation. We'll give you five CDs of some of the best people. And Noam Chomsky is part of this series. Also, Nancy McLean is part of the series. Chuck Collins, Caroline Fredrickson, William Barber, who we heard a speech by earlier this week. And you can have any five speeches from the Alternative Radio series for a $200 contribution. Hey, Sean, how are you?
I'm doing great, Rob. And that $200 deal is really a fantastic bargain because we're giving away the speeches at $80 for a CD. So if you get five of them for $200, that's about like half price. So if you can afford that and you'd like to support your local radio station, getting those five speeches for a $200 donation is a really great bargain, and we need to hear from you right now. 813-238-8001. If you're a fan of Rob's show, Radioactivity, what a great show every morning at 11. He brings you fantastic interviews, and you can call in and make your thoughts known as well. Well, now we need you to call in, but to make a donation to keep it going. 813-238-8001.
And speaking of the Alternative Radio series, we're going to hear one of those speeches right now, and you can get this speech. In fact, if you get this one and four others for a $200 contribution, that's certainly possible. You can have this one speech for an $80 contribution. Remember, you can make your contribution online at WMNF.org. Let's listen to Benjamin Hepp talking about the rise of Nazism in Europe in the 1930s. And this speech is yours for an $80 contribution to WMNF. And for a $200 contribution, we'll give you this speech and four more. So stick around.
there were refugee and migrant flows, particularly across Germany's eastern border. So this is really where Hitler comes in, because the message that Hitler and the Nazis started to develop with great political success in the late 20s is basically, we're the party that will stop this. We're the party of, if I might put it this way, putting Germany first or making Germany great again. There are historians who tell us Hitler is what happens when you have too much democracy. And there are historians who tell us Hitler is what happens when you don't have enough democracy.
That's Benjamin Hett, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Benjamin Hett on how Hitler happened. The post-World War I Weimar Republic in Germany was the height of European civilization. Its scientists and scholars led the world. Its Bauhaus architecture was the rage. Its arts featured such luminaries as Fritz Lang, Bertolt Brecht, Kurt Weill, and Thomas Mann. Yet out of this modern democracy sprang Nazism, German fascism, and one of the most barbaric regimes ever. How did Hitler happen? It is one of the most important questions of history. What happened in Germany has disturbing resonances for our own time. Fascist-like regimes are taking power in many countries. We ignore disturbing signs at our peril, from torchlight parades in Charlottesville with crowds chanting, "Jews will not replace us," to a synagogue massacre in Pittsburgh, to the murder of African Americans in a church in Charleston. What can we learn from the past to ensure it doesn't happen again? Our guest today is Benjamin Hett. He's the author of Burning the Reichstag, Crossing Hitler, and The Death of Democracy. He's a professor of history at Hunter College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. I talked with him in his office at Hunter College in New York. The origins of the Nazi Party, you write, the National Socialist German Workers' Party emerged from the German Workers' Party that was formed in 1919. It was a fringe party, you write, until the late 1920s when it began to win significant support, first in Protestant rural areas. When Hitler took over as the party's leader in 1920, he added National Socialist to its name.
One thing this shows, I think, is the political cleverness of Hitler. The DAP, the German Workers' Party, was just another of any number of radical right-wing fringe movements that were springing up in Munich right after the war in 1919. And the DAP would have gone nowhere at all if Hitler, on one occasion when he was working as kind of a political spy for the army, hadn't wandered into one of their meetings and been incensed by a speaker who advocated Bavarian secession from Germany. And Hitler rose and poured a torrent of abuse on this man, as only Hitler could. And this impressed the heck out of the other people in the DAP. The man who had founded the DAP, a man named Anton Drexler, heard Hitler speak, and he said, that guy's got a mouth on him. We could use him. And so they tried to sort of draw Hitler into their party to be their speaker, which, of course, they succeeded at. And then about 6 months later, under Hitler's leadership, they reformulated the party as not the DAP, but the NSDAP, National Socialist German Workers' Party. That National Socialist is interesting because in conventional political terms, certainly at that time, that should have been a total oxymoron. Because national implying nationalist, on the one hand, and socialist, which is conventionally thought of as an internationalist ideology. So a national socialism should be an oxymoron, but it was Hitler's cleverness to see how this could be a kind of political marketing pitch, how you could basically present not actually a socialism in Marxist terms, but a kind of egalitarianism that was also nationalist, and that might be a potent electoral appeal, which it took a while to catch on, but that turned out to be right.
You write that the Nazis were able to win a significant support, first in Protestant rural areas. Why Protestant rural areas?
This is an interesting fact about German politics in this era, and I think this is something that's probably not really widely known. As often happens in politics, there was a constituency that could be a natural constituency for the Nazi message, and then there were other constituencies that were not. There were basically three blocks in German political society. The socialist working class bloc, there was the Catholic bloc, and then there was a slightly more amorphous group, which we might call the Protestant middle class bloc. Even when the Nazis started to do really well in electoral appeal after 1928-29, they never made really deep inroads into either the socialist working classes or the Catholic constituency, where they really not only made inroads, but basically took over this segment of the voting public, was with what we would call the Protestant middle class camp. The reasons for that go to is what it was the Nazis were really offering. We tend to think of them now as being primarily anti-Semitic and perhaps primarily or secondarily militaristic. But neither of those notions were at the forefront of Nazi campaigning when they started to attract support. What the Nazis really were in the late 20s and early 30s, in terms of their messages to voters and in terms of which voters caught that message and responded to it, they were an anti-globalist protest movement. And this goes a long way to explaining why it is that they were able to capture Protestant votes, particularly in rural areas, because this was a time in which across the sort of north and east of Germany, the agricultural heartland, so to speak, that region was being really hit by trends in the global economy at the time, notably a dramatic drop in world grain prices, so that it was becoming very difficult to make a living farming, and rural areas were really hit by this and were experiencing a lot of poverty, which led to a lot of protest and a lot of anger at the Democratic Republic, which people thought was responsible for this situation, and a lot of anger at broader forces in the global economy and trade and so on, which seemed to be bringing this on. And the Nazis really positioned themselves as nationalists and against global trade, and they certainly positioned themselves as burningly hostile to the Democratic Republic. And it's fascinating that we see these messages really starting to resonate in these Protestant rural areas where even before the Nazis achieved a real breakthrough in a national election, which was 1930, but already in 1928, 1929, they're starting to do a lot better in state elections by capturing this rural Protestant vote.
And you write that religious belief was a huge component of rural identity. For German Protestants, the male-centered family was the core of the social order. And then you add that the Weimar Republic concentrated in one package everything Protestants didn't like.
There's, I think, a sort of interesting parallel here to things that we're all familiar with. This is one way in which Weimar Germany looks quite familiar. There was a kind of culture war with a strong religious component. A lot of Protestants, particularly Protestants in rural areas, strongly disliked several things which seemed to be characteristic of the new era of the 1920s. They disliked the life of big cities. They disliked all of the sort of cultural things that seemed to go with that: sexual experimentation, changes in gender roles, a sort of drift away from the church. They disliked the political prominence of the urban working classes manifested in social democratic influence in the New Republic. And also they tended to see it as too Jewish, because they tended to equate, in a sort of general way, all of these modern trends to, you know, political democracy, to individual rights and so on, a lot of modern art of the time. They tended to think, well, this is all actually really Jewish. So they thought, you know, Weimar is too Jewish, it's too Catholic, it's too urban, it's too Berlin, because all of these modern things were very much centered in Berlin. And here, too, the Nazis were able to really play to that and say, you know, we're the party that's against all this. Here is where Nazi anti-Semitism, a little bit in a dog whistle form, played a role. They positioned themselves as against all the sort of modern artistic experimentation, gender experimentation, and so on that seemed to be characteristic of Berlin in that area, and that era, and that, too, tended to consolidate their support in exactly those groups where they were doing well. Anyway, the sort of Protestant rural and Protestant middle class constituency.
And in terms of the Weimar Republic, what is its structure politically?
Yeah, so the Weimar Republic is the sort of informal name we give to the state that gets formed out of that revolution that comes at the end of World War I, where basically the Social Democrats take over. And then early in 1919, the Social Democrats had a very clear idea of what they wanted to do. They wanted to have national elections for a constituent assembly that would draft a new constitution. They had these elections in January. The Social Democrats won them in the sense that they got the biggest vote share. They didn't get a majority on their own, but with particularly two other democratic parties, the Catholic Center and the left liberal German Democrats, these three together had a very big majority. So they created this highly democratic political system, this new constitution. And the new constitution came into effect in August 1919. It also had built into it some things which would turn out to be problematic, which the framers didn't foresee. These really revolve around the power of the presidency. So the office of the presidency was separate from the parliament, or the Reichstag. So the president was separately elected by the whole people for a different term. The parliamentary term was 4 years, the presidential term was 7 years. And very faithfully, the president was equipped with emergency powers under Article 48 of the Constitution, probably the most famous part of this Constitution, so that in an emergency, the president could do by decree pretty much anything he wanted. This created the possibility that the president might be able to function as a dictator, issuing these decrees. Now, the framers didn't think this was a problem because it didn't really occur to them an opponent of democracy might get elected to the presidency of a democracy. I think you can't blame them for maybe not thinking that that was a possibility, for that not having occurred to them. But in fact, that's pretty much precisely what happened in 1925 when the World War I commander, Field Marshal Paul von Hindenburg, in a real squeaker of an election, got elected to the presidency. And that then created the condition where you have a man who really is someone who doesn't like the democratic system occupying the very powerful office of the presidency and with access to these emergency powers. That creates one of the ground conditions which then in a few years' time makes it possible for the democracy to really go down the drain.
Talk about the rise of Hitler, the failed push in Munich in 1923, and what class of people, if one could generalize, did the Nazi movement attract?
At the beginning, Hitler was a very, very unlikely person to follow a successful path in German politics. German politicians generally, and this is true even of people from the working class parties like the Social Democrats, they tended to be well-educated, politically thoughtful, well-read. Hitler was very much a horse of a different color. He had fought in the German army in World War I, but he had very little going for him. He had no family name, no money, you know, very little formal education behind him. What he did have, as it turned out, as we know, is a remarkable talent as a public speaker. He also had some slightly less visible talents. He had a remarkable ability to perceive what people thought and felt and wanted to hear, both on an individual basis and when dealing with crowds. He was very, very politically cunning, and he had very strong nerves. He was able to sort of wait for a moment to strike when people around him often were saying, we've got to do something now, and he would have the sort of gambler's nerve to hold out. In terms of whom he started to appeal to, in the earlier days, from the end of World War I until his famous beer hall putsch or coup attempt in 1923, he was really a regional phenomenon. He was active in and around Munich. He started to attract a Bavarian following, largely made up of people who had been dislocated by the war, really. It was a following of war veterans who couldn't settle down to peacetime, who had a sort of urge to political nationalism, which the war had probably fostered, and a hatred of the Marxist left, and were happy to be in a situation where they could break some left-wing skulls. And then, generally speaking, those being very rough economic years in Germany, Hitler attracted a following of people who were being hurt by the post-war economic crises, and who in various ways either yearned for a return to the good old days or yearned for a return or a move towards some better future, but it's not the present. In social class terms, probably his early following was more mixed than it would become later. It may have been sort of centered in the kind of lower middle class craftsman, tradesman milieu, But there were a lot of, there were some sort of prominent wealthy business people around Munich who were attracted to him. The soldiers who were disaffected war veterans often came from very mixed backgrounds. It was later on that the Nazi following sort of crystallized around Protestant, rural, middle class, and to some extent upper middle class. That would have been less evident in Bavaria in the early days.
Well, we're going to hear more of this interview with Benjamin Hett, the professor from Hunter College, about his latest book, which is called The Death of Democracy, about the rise of Hitler in Germany in the late 1920s and early 1930s. Terrific book. And if you want to get a copy of this interview, you can make an $80 contribution to WMNF. We're fundraising here at WMNF. If you're just tuning in, we start our fund drive on Tuesday morning about 9 o'clock, and we are trying to raise $250,000 over 7 days. We've had a really good past 2 days, and today we're hoping to stay on track and raise, between now and 1 o'clock, we're trying to raise $8,000. That's a lot of money, I know, so we're going to need to get at least one $1,000 contribution. We will give you a bunch of speeches and interviews on CD if you want. We'll include this one that we're listening to now. You can have this standalone interview for an $80 contribution if you call us at 813-238-8001. That's 813-238-8001. We have some really great phone answers in the back. They'll take your phone call. They'll ask you a few questions like, what's your address? How would you like to pay? And what are your favorite shows on WMNF? That's what happens when you call in. It's a pretty quick phone call. And also, you can make your contribution online at WMNF.org. This is normally the Radioactivity Hour, normally you'd be hearing me interview somebody, and then we'd open up the phone lines and maybe talk about the interview or talk about something that's going on in national or international or local news. Today, we're fundraising here at WMNF. Sean Kinnan is with me, and we're going to try to get at least one phone call this break. We're going to go back to more of this interview in just about 2 minutes, but let's see if we can get one phone call right now from some good listener. Maybe you're in South Tampa, maybe you're in Seminole, or maybe you're in Clearwater or Largo, maybe you're in Tarpon Springs or Sarasota or Bradenton or Waimama or Riverview or Temple Terrace, wherever you are, wherever you're listening around the Tampa Bay area. This is a big radio station. We have quite a powerful signal. We get out to a lot of people. A lot of tourists hear us and then take us back home. They use the WMNF app and listen to us when they go back to Massachusetts or New York or Chicago. This is a unique radio station, nothing like it anywhere in Florida. So we're struggling to raise that money to keep this radio station going. And today we want to hear from about 80 people between now and 1 o'clock. Please call us at 813-238-8001. Sean, if we could just get one good person, maybe calling from St. Petersburg or Clearwater right now, I think they might, reading their name might inspire other people to call in.
Yeah, we do need to hear from you. 813-238-8001 is the number for you to call and show your support with your $100 donation or your $500 donation. We'd really like to hear from people who can join our circle of friends. And what that is that's a monthly sustaining membership. We'll send you the paperwork, and then you fill it out, and you can donate $5 a month or $10 a month or $20 or however much you decide. If it's $5 or more, and it'll come either out of your checking account or out of your credit card. You decide. So that's the best way to sustain, to financially sustain your radio station. The number to call is 813-238-8001. You can always make a donation on the web at WMNF.org or on the WMNF smartphone app, but we do need to hear from you right now.
And there's very few radio stations in the Bay Area that would bring you an historian for an hour talking about an issue that really hits home. I mean, we worry today about the rise of fascism in the U.S., and there are all sorts of signs out there, and you know the signs. So please help this beacon of light stay on the air. Our phone number is 813-238-8001. We're hoping for just one phone call right now, wherever you're at. If you're in the Gandy Boulevard area of St. Petersburg or Tampa, you might be... you know, on the road. You may be in Avon Park. You may be in Lakeland. You might be in Winter Haven. Please call us at 813-238-8001. Let us know that you're out there and keep this beacon of light alive. Just hoping for one person this break, and then I think by reading your name during the next break, that's going to inspire other people. You can also make your contribution online at WMNF.org. That's WMNF.org. We're listening to Benjamin Hett. The title of this interview is How Hitler Happened. He's a professor of history at Hunter College, and he's written several books, including his latest, which is called The Death of Democracy. And if you get a chance to pick up that book, I urge you to do so, because the parallels between Hitler's rise in the late 1920s and early 1930s, there are some parallels between what happened in Germany then and what's going on right now in the U.S. Hett has been talking about the powerful presidency, nationalism, opposition to trade, the rise of conservative religious groups. The president just spoke to a conservative religious group this morning, and he lashed out at House Democrats, He said the Democrats are corrupt people at the National Prayer Breakfast this morning, and I'm just reading from the Washington Post. So these are really tough times for a lot of people, we hope that, you know, there's a lot of radio stations out there, so if you're looking for other points of view, you can certainly get them, but this is the only radio station in the Tampa Bay area that is warning about the danger of fascism and the rise of fascism. And we hope that you make a contribution to WMNF. We'll give you five speeches or five interviews from the alternative radio series. I'll pick them out for you. Tell me what you're generally interested in. And the kind of interview that we're listening to right now is pretty typical of the alternative radio series. And we've got we have more than 20 different speeches from the alternative radio series, but I'll pick five out for you, and that's for a $200 contribution. Now, Sean, we haven't, the first donation has not walked into the studio yet, so we're hoping to get at least one phone call right now at 813-238-8001.
Will you be the first one during Radioactivity? Will you be the super fan who kicks it all off for us and gets things moving? 813-238-8001. Get this five CD package from the best speeches from alternative radio for a $200 donation, or any individual one for an $80 contribution. We have lots of thank you gifts. We have our new t-shirts, a $120 contribution for the long sleeve t-shirt, $88.50 contribution for the men's or women's cut in the short sleeves. It says 40 years and into the future. You can see the design on our website, WMNF.org. If you go to that website, you can also pick out your thank you gift and make your donation right there on the web. It's very simple. It'll take you about 2 minutes. You can also donate online on our WMNF smartphone app, or you can call 813-238-8001 and talk to one of our great volunteers.
And Sean, we're going to hear more of this interview with Benjamin Hett in just a moment. One more thank you gift that we haven't talked about, and we only have one of these. Valentine's Day is coming up in just a few days, and we will give you a gift certificate to Burns Steakhouse in Tampa. This is one of the premier restaurants in Tampa. It's a $100 gift certificate, and we'll give you a bottle of wine that Burns has donated to us for a $200 contribution. Now, this is something that you're going to have to come down to M&F and pick up. We don't want to mail the bottle of wine, but we will give you the $100 gift certificate and a bottle of wine from Burns for a $200 donation. So you'll be covering your bases for Valentine's Day, and you'll be helping WMNF in a really big way. 813-238-8001.
Rob, I'd like to thank our first, we are getting our first donations in, so I hope this inspires you to make your contribution at 813-238-8001. We're getting a $100 donation from Bill Lee in St. Petersburg and supports all of the programming. Thank you.
Thanks, Bill.
And also Bill Grable. Thank you, Bill, from Tampa, and he's donating $100. A big shout out to Rob and Sean.
Thank you, Bill.
So he says very nice things about Rob being an amazing journalist, and he says nice things about both of us. So thank you very much, Bill.
And thanks to Anonymous in Sarasota. They made a contribution of $10 a month on our Circle of Friends. So we've had three donations. We only we need to hear from 80 more people. Let's go back and hear more of this interview with Benjamin Hett. The topic is How Hitler Happened. And he's right. He's written a great new book called The Death of Democracy. Here's more of that interview that David Barsamian did with him.
And when and why does Hitler tap into anti-Jewish, anti-Semitism, which he didn't invent but had been, you know, rooted in German culture, parts of German culture?
Before World War One, anti-Semitism on the German right had become a kind of cultural code. It almost had nothing to do with any real Jewish people. It was a sort of glue that held together a package of things which people on the right tended to believe. That package including certainly nationalism, militarism, a kind of hyper-masculinity, and a corresponding kind of contempt for women and contempt for feminism. A sort of general dislike of modernity and what it meant in terms of urbanization and industrialization and new forms of business like department stores, for instance. All of this package could sort of get tied in a knot, and reference to Jews and to anti-Semitism could be kind of the shorthand that could in a way convey this whole package. So that's where things were when Hitler sort of picks things up in 1919. Now, Hitler certainly believed very strongly in a kind of not religiously based, but really, as he thought, racially based idea of anti-Semitism. He believed that Jews were a definable racial group, and that definition as such had just about nothing to do with religious affiliation in any way. And this is the idea he starts to talk about in 1919. What he does, and what a lot of people on the right in that time did, was he would rhetorically link Jews both to the political democracy of Weimar, which, of course, people on the right hated, and he would also certainly link Jews to one of the other major political factors of the time, which was the emerging communist regime in the Soviet Union. And the idea grew up that, well, Jews are behind that. Jews are behind, you know, the Bolshevik regime in Russia is basically a Jewish regime, just as Hitler would argue to a great degree the democracy of Germany was a Jewish system. And then the other element of this, something that became very characteristic on the right in those days, is that Hitler also linked international finance to Jews. So you have this situation where anti-Semitic discourse is being used to link global finance and the communism of the Soviet Union, all tied together as being supposedly two faces of the world Jewish conspiracy. Now, this is something Hitler certainly talked about in the earlier years in Munich, 1919 to 1923. What is interesting, and I think is important to understand, is that after the failure of the Beer Hall Putsch in 1923, and the Nazis sort of go into a trough for a while, when they start to reemerge from that trough around 1928, Hitler's talking about Jews, and he's sort of using anti-Semitic tropes less and less. And he uses them less and less, really the closer the Nazis get to power. So they start to do really well in national elections after 1930. He's really not talking about Jews much, except in a kind of dog whistle way. I mean, if you look at his speeches, he would say things like, you know, he would talk about international finance spiders, for instance. And his audience would know what he meant, but he wasn't saying it very explicitly. He talked, as he rose towards power, he talked a lot about communism and socialism, and he portrayed his party as the most determined enemy of Marxism. And he talked a lot about the global economy. And these were the vote-getting things. Hitler understood that anti-Semitism, in U.S. terms, we would say, he understood it was a base issue for his sort of most dedicated followers, but it was not an issue that was going to get him, you know, big numbers of votes out there in the sort of broad middle classes that he wanted to attract.
People expressed surprise at the trajectory the Nazi movement took, but had they read Mein Kampf, which was Hitler's book, My Struggle, he lays out pretty clearly what his intentions were. So why this surprise?
I think there are probably a few reasons for that. I don't think we know exactly. I mean, it would be hard to get data on how many people read Mein Kampf in the 1920s or early 30s. I mean, we have data on the sales, which really tailed off after the middle of the 1920s. But of course, lots of people probably bought the thing and put it on their shelves and ignored it. It is, along with being, of course, a deeply offensive book, it is an incredibly boring book. I mean, it's not a good read. So it would be hard to imagine too many people plowing through all of those turgid pages. In any case, even if you did read it, and of course you're absolutely right that Hitler makes very clear in Mein Kampf, you know, it's on every page, basically, his toxic hatred of Jews. And he makes very clear what his long-term scenario for Germany is. He makes very clear that he thinks Germany needs to rearm and launch a war to conquer Lebensraum, or territory, in Eastern Europe, in basically Poland and the Soviet Union. So these are the things he wanted to do, and of course these are the things he did, once he could. But I think you need to remember that this was a politician's autobiography. And, you know, this is a genre we're very familiar with. And if you believe everything that's in a politician's autobiography, well, as we like to say in New York, I've got a bridge for you. So, you know, and of course, there's also the issue, and some people did say this, that by the time Hitler is sort of knocking on the doors of power in the early 1930s, it's almost 10 years since the Beer Hall Putsch, and almost that since the publication of Mein Kampf. And so a reasonable person could say, well, okay, you know, that book, that was Hitler, the sort of beer hall radical, but now he's Hitler, the major party leader, and perhaps, you know, about to be Reich Chancellor. Power always makes radicals calm down. This is a very common political experience. So I think even for people who were aware of what he had said in Mein Kampf, it just didn't seem very important. And, you know, with hindsight, that obviously looks bad, but I think it's easy to understand how that could happen in the moment. We, I'm sure, do the same thing every day.
Perhaps the most cogent and well-written chapter in Mein Kampf is the one on propaganda. Propaganda was, of course, central to the Nazi movement.
Yeah, that's right. A number of people commented on the time that when Hitler got to propaganda, you could see, as one sophisticated political commentator put it, you could see a man who really knows what he's talking about here. And it's true. I mean, Hitler had certainly a cynical and unappealing, but nonetheless rather shrewd understanding of how politics works on some level. So, for instance, there's the famous passage in Mein Kampf where he talks about lying. And he raises this in the context of a critique of something he thinks Jews do, but it's clear from how he writes it. What he's saying is telling a big lie in politics can be very effective, much more effective than telling a little lie, because what he says is every human being tells little lies all the time. We're familiar with that. People will recognize it right away if a politician does it, and they'll kind of write him off. But if you tell a big lie, most people don't tell whoppers all the time. So if you tell a big lie, people will think that must be right. Even if the lie should then be debunked, it will leave a residue.
Hitler also attracts someone by the name of Joseph Goebbels, who becomes later Minister of Popular Enlightenment and Propaganda. It was Goebbels, you write, who thought carefully about how to persuade people. Simple messages endlessly repeated.
Goebbels was sort of the perfect complement to Hitler. I often think Goebbels is one of the most interesting of the main Nazis, precisely because he was probably the most intelligent. This is a guy with a PhD in literature, a man of actually quite sophisticated cultural taste. And what I find really fascinating about Goebbels, and it's really, really, really unusual in human beings, is that on the one hand, he was an absolute political fanatic. No question, he was a, you know, as they used to say in Germany, 110% Nazi. He worshipped Hitler. He was absolutely with the program. He was a ferocious anti-Semite. He's an absolutely hardcore Nazi. And yet, and this is the thing that's remarkable, because of his flexible intelligence, he could also kind of separate himself from that, and he could imagine how Nazism looked to somebody who was an anti-Nazi. And he could really put himself in that way of thinking, which meant that he could then think very effectively about how to pitch that person, basically, about what kind of message Nazis could make that might appeal to people who weren't Nazis. He had the mental flexibility to do this. That's what I think is super unusual. I mean, most of us, you know, whatever political views we hold, we sort of can't imagine thinking from the other side, but Goebbels really could. And this is what made him, I think, so good at his job, because he was an extremely good architect of Nazi propaganda. There are a number of people who say that, you know, Hitler might not have been possible as a major political phenomenon without Goebbels to do a fair bit of his thinking for him.
And talk about the nature of Nazi propaganda, and you write about the cult of irrationality that drove their followers, the contempt for, indeed, the revolution against Enlightenment standards of rationality.
Yeah, what the Nazis did very successfully is really change the terms in which politics was spoken about. They introduced a much more bullying, violent tone. I mean, not just in literal violence, but in language, in how they spoke and how they depicted things. There was a real change in discourse. They would talk much more scathingly, much more hatefully about their opponents than was typical. They would use violence in their speech all the time. They kind of normalized this extremely aggressive, you know, rapid deterioration, basically, in the nature of public discourse. And people at the time were very aware of this, that they were doing this. An element of this certainly was their utter contempt for facts, basically, if at least if the facts were inconvenient, and their cleverness at playing on emotional themes in ways that might resonate politically but weren't things you could sort of necessarily demonstrate logically. But, you know, what it may have captured is a sort of willingness to do something that was going to be better without really being able to articulate what that thing was. I mean, it goes very well with the sort of common Nazi slogan and the title of the famous film, Triumph of the Will. If you just will something, then it can happen, no matter how, you know, unfriendly the actual factual reality might be. Which, of course, was a Nazi attitude pretty much through to the end, when, you know, Hitler's in the bunker and Berlin's in ruins and his army has basically all been killed, but he's at the map table talking about moving divisions here and there that don't exist. I mean, this sort of contempt for reality was a running theme all the way through.
And one might say, given contemporary politics in the United States, that there is a kind of contempt for science, for the facts, for truth. It seems to be movable facts and movable truths.
Alternative facts, yeah. It's certainly something that worries me a good deal about our time and our political culture, that there seems to be this increasing anti-intellectualism, but even more than anti-intellectualism, or in addition to it, as you said, this kind of contempt for anything that's actually verifiable evidence, that's actually the reality of what's happening around us. Instead, we seem to want to retreat into sort of convenient, nice fables that might be comforting and pleasant, but are not the reality.
Well, we're listening to an interview with Benjamin Hett, who's a professor at Hunter College, and his book is called The Death of Democracy. This interview is called How Hitler Happened, and you can have this interview for an $80 contribution. It is a fantastic interview. As you've been listening to it, you notice that he talks about how the Nazis used contempt for facts, bullying, normalized aggression, also propaganda, hatred of socialism and communism, hypermasculinity, militarism, nationalism, conservative religious groups. So these were all parts of how Nazis rose to power and how Hitler rose to power in Germany. We're going to hear more of this interview, maybe after the top of the hour. At the top of the show, we needed to hear from 80 people, 80 donors, because we are fundraising here at WMNF. And this week, we're trying to raise $250,000. And for the next hour or so, we've got to raise a total of, we've got to raise about $8,000. Actually, we started at 11 o'clock. We need to raise $8,000. We're a lot closer than that. We're going to tell you how close in just a moment. Sean Canan is here. I'm Rob Lori. Thanks to Amy Parsons from St. Petersburg. She made a $100 contribution. And Amy, thank you for your kind words. Michelle Hamill is donating $10 a month. Michelle is from Tampa. And she says, if Simon can donate $20, I definitely can contribute this time around. Thank you, Michelle.
Thank you
for your nice contribution. Sean, you've got some people to thank, too.
I do. Catherine from Valrico is donating $200, is getting the gift certificate from Happy Feet for Kenko Massage Sandals. And Michelle says, I think this show is great. Ramil Matsukis from Clearwater says, everybody needs to get off their beep and call in to donate now. Thank you for that $25 donation. Also, Michelle is donating $100, is getting tickets to our ruckus. And thank you for that donation from Newport Richie. We do need to hear from you, 813 233 888-238-8001. We've gotten some support right now. We've gotten a flurry of support, but we need to hear right now from you if you like Radioactivity, if you like our news and public affairs, if you are appreciative of this speech that we're playing you, a long-form interview with a historian from by David Barsamian. We need to hear from you right now. 813-238-8001.
And thanks to Al Haddad from Tampa. He enjoys the programs and the music. A $50 contribution. Al, thank you. And John Hubble from Holiday. John is taking a WMNF t-shirt for his $120 contribution. John Figliozzi from Clifton Park, Florida has made a $35 contribution. John, thank you. And Carol Pellegrino has made a $50 contribution. Carol, thank you very much for that nice contribution. Sean, you've got some more people to thank, too. Huh?
I do, and these people donated at WMNF.org or by calling 813-238-8001, and we'd like you to do the same. Stephen Pence from St. Petersburg has taken that Burns Steakhouse gift certificate for a $200 donation, so thank you to everyone who was interested. We'll try to get one again next drive. Alfred Hinson from Tampa says, I really appreciate you, Rob. You bring so much to the show, many topics, and much to learn. Also, Richard Wolf, so thank you for, and he's donating $35 from Tampa. Thank you, Alfred. And Ed Golly says he does a radio show from WTAN once a week, and he has bought an hour of time a week to fight the right wing. Ed is from Tampa, and he's donating $1,000 to 88.5.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for that donation. It's great to get a $1,000 donation. It's fantastic to get any amount, but we really could use another $1,000 donation. Can you be the person that will donate $1,000? We'll give you we'll give you an event pass for 13 months, and you can go to all of our shows. 813-238-8001.
Sean, I know a lot of people are at work, and so if you're able to drive around in your car now, or if you're at home now listening to this speech, or maybe you're at work and you're able to listen on the slide to this interview, rather, you may want to share it with friends, and you can get a copy of it for an $80 contribution. It's on CD. We'll give you the entire interview. We've heard about half of it so far. We'd like to hear more of it. I certainly want to hear the rest of it, but I'll tell you what, let's see if we can get one more phone call at 813-238-8001. That's 813-238-8001. Get this interview and get four more similar interviews and speeches for a total of $200. We have a subscription to Alternative Radio, which is a series of speeches and interviews that comes out of Boulder, Colorado, done by David Barsamian, who's doing the interview now with Benjamin Hett. And we have so many great programs from David that we'll give you five of these programs for a $200 contribution. Also, if you're interested in Medicare for All, we brought a businessman to town, to St. Petersburg, just a few days ago, and his name is Richard Master. He runs a frame company in Pennsylvania, and he thinks that single-payer or Medicare for All makes a lot of sense, and he's put his money where his mouth is. He has made a series of documentaries about the medical industry, about the pharmaceutical industry, and he makes the case in all of these that the government should be more active. We should have a single-payer healthcare system because that would help his business and many businesses like his. And he thinks that the government should negotiate to get lower drug prices because, for instance, the cost of insulin is so sky high. He's made four documentaries on our healthcare system and how to reform it. He's a business person, very successful. And for a $200 contribution, we'll give you the Richard Master documentary series. We only have one of these available, so you got to call us right now. 813-238-8001. That's 813-238-8001. Well, Sean, the good news is we needed 80 people before we started this hour, and now we need only 68 people, and we'll reach our goal. So we need 68 more people between now and 1 o'clock to donate $10 a year, maybe $35 a year, maybe $50 a year. Some people can afford $500 or $1,000, whatever you have in your budget to support a community radio station that speaks truth to power, that brings out all sorts of fantastic interviews about state, local, national, and international politics. Please make the contribution to WMNF today and help us stay on the air. You can make your contribution online at WMNF.org, but we just need to hear from 68 more people, and we'll be there. We've got a lot of great ways to thank you, including the documentary film Where's My Roy Cohn, that links Roy Cohn, the ruthless, unscrupulous lawyer, to Joseph McCarthy, the senator who carried out the witch hunts in the 1950s, and also to Donald Trump. Where's My Roy Cohn? It's on DVD. It can be yours for $120 contribution. 813-238-8001.
We do need to hear from you right now. We've only got a few minutes before NPR headlines, and we want to bring you midpoint today as well with the Surly Feminists. 813-238-8001 or WMNF.org. Can you take the 5-CD package for a $200 donation? We would really like to get your support for Radioactivity, and that's one great way to do it. 813-238-8001.
And if you have it in your budget, and if you can donate $1,000, that would really help us out big time, because some of the shows in the last 24 hours have fallen really far behind in reaching their goal. So we're going to need a hero to step forward and make a $1,000 contribution to WMNF. I know that's a lot, but you know, if you've got it and you want to put your money, invest your money in a place that really has values, that believes in peace and social justice and equality and human rights and care for the environment, everything that MNF stands for, we hope you'll make that contribution today. And if you can't afford $1,000, we will graciously accept any donation. It could be $5, $10, $25, $50, $100, $75, $80. 813-238-8001. A lot of people are donating $100. When you donate $100, if you want, you can have the two-part Noam Chomsky interview, The Threats to Peace and the Planet. This is one of the most recent interviews that David Barsamian has done with Noam Chomsky, and you can have that 2-CD package for a $100 donation. And Sean, I'm looking at the phones, and suddenly they've gone blank. We had some lines lit there. It looked really good, and suddenly we are without friends and supporters here as we go down to the last 4 minutes to the news.
Well, Grateful Ed says, we make new friends is what WMNF stands for. So we do need your friendship. We need your support. Excuse me. We could really use we would like to know that there are people out there who will financially support Radioactivity and the great Midpoint and News and Public Affairs show that we bring you every morning and early afternoon here on 88.5. Will you be the next person to make a donation? Give us a call at 813-238-8001. We've told you about all these wonderful thank you gifts we have, but the best thank you gift is knowing that community radio will be on the air in West Central Florida. 813-238-8001. You can also donate online at WMNF.org or on the WMNF app.
And we've been listening to this historian, Benjamin Hatt, who's a professor at Hunter College in New York City. We've been listening to him for a half an hour. It's incredible what he's telling us, and the parallels to today are scary. But I can't think of another radio station that would, without commercial interruptions, or bring you a great interview like this. And we've played this interview two or three times before outside of fund drives. So now we're hoping that you will reward us with a contribution right now, 813-238-8001. We're down to the last 3 minutes before the NPR news. The Surly Feminists are coming up in the next hour. We only need to hear from 68 more people, and we'll be there. 813-238-8001.
Rob, I'd like to thank Rosemary Tantalo from Sarasota. She appreciates the David Barsamian series for a $25 contribution. William Schaefer from Sarasota says, looking good, Robin Sean, and is donating $200. And Dino Leto from Tampa says, enjoys all the programming, and especially Rob and Jeff Stewart's morning show. Thank you for that $20 donation. Well, we've got Sarasota representing and Tampa representing. Where is St. Petersburg? Where is Largo? Where is Lakeland? We need to hear from you right now. 813-238-8001. In 2 minutes, we'll go up to the Washington, D.C. to get NPR headlines. In that 2 minutes, I'd like to hear from two or three more people. Can you call us right now, 813-238-8001.
And Sean, I know Gulfport is a hotbed of MNF support. I don't think we've heard from anybody from Gulfport.
That can't be. You're letting me down, Gulfport.
We haven't heard from anybody from Gulfport this morning, so let's hear from somebody from Gulfport. 813-238-8001. Pinellas Park, where are you? Please check in with us. We're looking for people that want to make sure that this radio station stays alive and that we can be a beacon of truth and freedom and justice as we've been for the past four decades. You might be a new member. My guess is that you're a brand new listener to WMNF, and thank you for tuning in. You're figuring out what we're all about, and today would be a great time to make that contribution to WMNF. 813-238-8001. Sean, by my count, we're 65 calls away from reaching the goal today. So we, by 1 o'clock, we have to get 65 more phone calls. And people can make a contribution online at WMNF.org. Get the Richard Master documentary series about reforming healthcare. This is from the perspective of a business person who says that single-payer insurance would make a great deal of sense for him, and he's got a lot of business friends too. He's in Pennsylvania. He was down here in Tampa making a speech just a few days ago, and we've got his entire documentary series for a $200 contribution. 813-238-8001.
Or WMNF.org. You're listening to WMNF Tampa, St. Petersburg, Sarasota. Thanks so much for calling in. You can make a donation.